Welcome to What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander, the crossroads where culture, lifestyle, and community meet, all hosted by the legendary New York radio TV personality and proud Harlem American, G. Keith Alexander.
Well, thank you. Welcome to What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander. Wherever you are, I appreciate you for joining our neighborhood as we hang out together in Harlem America. Today, in the What's Hot spotlight, is Reuben Santiago Hudson. Reuben is an award-winning actor, writer, director, and producer known for his impactful work on stage, screen, and television. He directed the Broadway production of Skeleton Crew, which earned 4 Tony nominations, and his own autobiographical Lackawanna Blues, winning multiple awards and making history as the first person to write, direct, and star in a Broadway play. Reuben's production of Jitney won the Tony Award for Outstanding Revival, and he adapted August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom for Netflix. So, it is my distinct honor and pleasure to say Reuben Santiago Hudson is What's Hot. How you doing, Reuben?
I'm doing great, man. It's so good to be here with you, finally.
Yes, finally, after all these years, you know, but the reason being is, you know, whenever I tried to reach out to you, you were always busy in a production or rehearsing for a production or prepping. So finally, you know, you got a chance to find some time to hang out with us in Harlem, America. And that's so wonderful.
Had to make some time. I find it. Made it. Got to make some time. G. Keith called in that many times. I said, I got to be there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So what I normally do at this point in time is I ask my special guest to let's take the Wayback Machine and tell us what it was like growing up as little Reuben.
Oh, my God. Little Reuben grew up. My major growing up was in a rooming house, 32 Watson Avenue in Lackawanna. Now, prior to being there permanently, you know, I had a tumultuous younger life because my mother and father broke up, and my mother decided to, you know, spend more time, you know, being a young 20-year-old that was beautiful, more time, you know, working at the bar and being in the streets. So I ended up, you know, being with the woman who raised me, we called Nanny, Rachel Crosby, at the rooming house. She just finally took over and said, I'm taking the baby, go ahead and live your life. And when you're ready, come get this boy. And she did that with numerous kids, dozens of kids. Mm-hmm. And most of their parents did come back and get them. Unfortunately, my mother became a heroin addict. So I stayed with Nanny for the rest of my life. And then when I got to the point where, this is just a fast version, when I got to the point where I was a teenager and was a little hard to handle, she brought my godmother closer in, who was Maddie Overton, who would give me what she called the licking stick. And because Nanny allowed me to run free rein. So about 16, 17, you know, I got a little out of hand, and Mom Overton, as we called her, Maddie Overton, had to bring me, you know, straighten my little butt out, as they say, and put me on the right track. But it was a beautiful upbringing. In this rooming house, it was filled with colorful characters that the world didn't want, that Nanny gave a place to stay and helped them find jobs, social services, mental health, addiction help. She ran these two rooming houses. And in there, I'd walk in, I was like a little prince, because most people were illiterate. Many of them had traveled up from the South for one reason or another, to escape Jim Crow, to run away from a so-called crime, because, you know, the white authorities were making us criminals if we were on the corner too long. Okay. So sometimes we had to leave town. And a lot of those people came to Nanny's rooming house through a cousin told them, or a friend, a relative, a relation. And they would come and knock on our door at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'd wake up and Nanny be talking through the door at somebody, you know, who? You know, it's Pete McQuillan. From where? You know, down in, you know, Augusta, Georgia. Who you know? You know, Lil Smitty from, you know, and then next thing you know, Nanny's letting him in and feeding him. It's 3 in the morning, and she's telling me, go to bed, boy. You know, and I'm shaking my head, don't let him in, because he got a scar across his face. You know, it was beautiful. And there's times when these men who couldn't read or write would depend on me to be their eyes and ears and brain and figuring things out. And so it made me an avid reader, and Nanny bought me a set of an encyclopedia so I can solve their arguments. She said, go find it in the book, baby, and I'd find it in the book, whether the Nile was longer than the Mississippi, or was the moon bigger than the earth. They would argue about everything, and their bets would be a drink or a smell. So when they got paid on Friday, somebody would have to give the person a drink, and they get to smell it, and the person drink it, you know. And I watched all these characters navigate America, the world, and their spot in life. And I told stories to them. I repeated stories that they told to me, and I would tell them back to them. And so that's where acting started, really, you know, loving the attention and the applause, you know. And these stories never left me. And that's the reason, as we'll talk later on, that August Wilson and I became close, because he had a similar upbringing, far as the raconteurs and the number man and the pool shark and all them, the stories that we heard them tell. Because in Nanny's rooming house, she had a pool table, and mm-hmm. bets never stopped. Mm-hmm. Sometime I would shoot the stick, and they would just, I bet on Doc, because they called me Doc, because they said I was going to be a doctor, because I, you know, I had good meat on my head. I had a good brain, they said. And they called me Doc. Doc would shoot it for me, and you know, I learned how to shoot pool that way. I watched the fish fries, the blackjack games, the barbecue cooking contests. You know, so everything that's culturally specific about us as people of color, you know, I had a front row seat.
Get down. Well, I remember maybe 35 years ago, you and I were walking from somewhere, and you told me that you were writing a play called Lackawanna Blues, and you actually fulfilled your dream and got 4 Tony nominations for it. But was that the basis of your growing up? That story?
That is my story. That is me, this boy, looking at what goodness is, why this woman is so good to everybody, a thing that I to this day cannot understand. And I attribute it to a simple line in the play. Sometimes there's an understanding between God and an individual that only they know. So that, you know, when I would ask Nanny why she would do for people who had stolen from her, people who had robbed banks, people who were murderers, why would you help this person? And Nanny would look at me and wink and say, this is what I do.
Wow. Gee.
And so I was be able to be a witness and also a recipient of that grace, of that kindness, of that goodness, you know, is the reason that I am anything today, that I matter at all today, is because I didn't want to disappoint her. You know, she had given me so much that I said, and I ain't gonna cry. I usually cry. I'm getting older now. I cry at the drop of a hat. If I see a squirrel find a chestnut, I start crying. But I received that love. I received that goodness, and I witnessed so much of it. And that's why I wrote Lackawanna Blues. I never wanted anyone to forget that person in their community or their life that was their nanny, that was their savior, you know. And that's why I wrote Lackawanna Blues. It was specifically about Nanny, but generally about our incredible Black communities where that came together and made our own heaven on earth and took care of each other in a way that it's not that way anymore. And it's sad. And I wanted to remind people who we were. And a lot of people walked out and say, yeah, that's who we are. That's who we are. We take care of each other.
Well, as a young kid, leaving that storyline, how did you get into acting per se?
Well, if I recall correctly, I was in second grade, and I was the best reader in there because I've been reading all them doggone encyclopedias. And the teacher was going to do a little play. It was Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. And obviously the white kid's supposed to play Huck and Tom. But since they couldn't read as good as me, I ended up getting Huckleberry Finn. So I started acting. And here I was being made fun of most of the time because I lived in a rooming house by other kids. They would make fun of me. And then all of a sudden, everybody was clapping and screaming and pat me on the back and shaking my hand. And I was like, okay, I better do this again. and that's where it kind of started. And then it was an insatiable appetite that I had for performance. And as I grew older, there was in the community center, which we had a remarkable community center in Lackawanna called the Friendship House. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we in Lackawanna, as Black folk, we call it the Friendship House. But it's the friendship house. So at the friendship house, they had everything from sports to the military cadet group, to track and field, to singing groups, to African dance workshops. And they had theater. And I just, like a fish to water, I jumped into the theater, as well as I was doing athletics pretty strong, you know, and it never let me go, and I wouldn't let it go. And we just put a death hold on each other, me in theater and acting and in theater in general, and that's where I stayed.
And okay, so, all right, so you stayed in theater, and then you mentioned to me prior to starting the show, you really surprised, you know, I thought I knew you. Not all about you, but I thought I knew you as an actor and as a friend. And we see each other, you know, at various places, auditions, maybe sometimes with voiceovers and on camera things. But you shocked me when you told me that you were a DJ at one time.
Yeah, I was a disc jockey. I was a DJ. I started out at Binghamton University. As I was saying earlier, I was impressed that they called me and said, you know, you're in the Binghamton University Radio Hall of Fame. And I'm like, what? Wow. You know, WHRW, you know, and my nickname was the Tyrant.
The Tyrant
that lived on a hill, you know, so, you know, and I had all those, the Tyrant, you know, but we had the Discotizer, the Manipulator, Kelly Cool Porter. We had all these names, Sister Beer Cheek. We had, you know, and we all had a name, and I was the Tyrant, you know, because I didn't take a whole lot of stuff from a lot of people. I was very angry and mean and, you know, just angry at the world for racism and different things. And then when I was going to school, there was a lot of racism. People drive by in a BMW convertible and call you a name that you're not, you know, and you had to chase them down and stuff. So I was angry. And so I got the reputation of being the Tyrant.
Though I played
good music now. Then when I got out of college, and I needed a hustle because theater wasn't paying. It really don't pay that much now. But I needed, and I said, let me go back to what I know. I mean, I know I could do voiceover, I could do programming, you know. So I went in and to Buffalo. I went home to Buffalo. Lackawanna is right next to Buffalo. And I went in. And what was that guy's name who was a programmer? He let me come in and do some spots. He liked my little, I had my cassette. In those days, we had cassette people, y'all young
right,
folks.
Right.
And he heard my commercials I had done in Binghamton and my promos. And he let me do production work. So if you couldn't afford G. Keith Alexander, you know, and you had a floral shop, you know, you would, you know, he would throw me into production for 2 hours, you know, and then I would do the master in floral shop, making floral arrangements for all occasions, you know, and then you do that thing. And I got a little money.
Really?
So eventually he let me spin. He said, you come on my show and spin. You spin? I said, yeah, I spin. In those days, we were spinning. We wasn't just carting. You know,
right.
You and I know what we talk about, you know.
Right.
Our program. So I spun for... about a half hour on this Sunday show. That led to an hour. That led to, you know, 3 hours. So that was WFO until, you know, as you know, they were owned by the Sheraton Broadcasting Company.
Mm-hmm.
The general manager came up and he was going to bring somebody to WAMO in Pittsburgh, WAMO.
Mm-hmm.
And he listened for a week. He sat in the general manager's office and listened for a week. And we were all battling to see who was going to take the WAMO. I wanted to be an actor. I was going to want to get back to acting.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually offered me the job. And I turned it down, and my father thought I'd lost my mind. And then I went
really?
Back to Detroit. Hey, listen, it was a salary position, 6 months, rent-free, billboard, morning man.
Wow.
So that's a big spot, as you know. Morning man, you know,
it
6
is.
To 10, you know, drive time and everything. It was like a killer job. And
that's
I told
right.
my father I wasn't going to do it. And his strongest Spanish accent, you lose your mind? You crazy? You know, what you going to do? You got money? You got money? Why you talking? You know? I said, Dad, I'm an actor. And what broke my heart too, G. Keith, I don't want to get off on him. I did a spot for a place called Sylvester's Nightclub in Buffalo. And it was Sylvester's Nightclub. Monday night is Alabama night, Tuesday night is, you know, you're doing that whole thing. And
right.
I would go, you know, everything's free. And I told the owner one day, I said, you know, I want to do a one-man show in here. I'm writing this piece called Lackawanna Blues. He laughed in my face. He said, you're a DJ, man. Ain't you supposed to introduce Luther and Evelyn Champagne King? And I'm like, well, I'm trying to get that gig, but I want to do this. I want to do a play. And he laughed in my face. And I said, I got to go back to the stage. And I went back to Detroit. And me and my buddy started a theater company. And I stayed there for 3 years.
Incredible. What a great story. I just want to let people know that Wolfo in Buffalo is where Frankie Crocker and Jerry B and Gary Bird and all those famous DJs that we know here in New York got started. And Ruben Santiago Hudson followed in their footsteps.
But I wasn't a big guy. Now, hold on now. I just have my little show. I was getting ready to be a big guy. You know, I would do the weekend show, and then I got to get some plugs during the week. But I was headed to Wham-O. And it made those other DJs. I remember one DJ in particular, mm-hmm. and he put Grease, I'll never forget this, on my album, one of my albums. And we had albums. I don't know, you young people might not understand this listening. We had albums. So you would hold that album while the turntable's gone and be talking your stuff, 98.7 or whatever, and all of a sudden let it go right on the beat. Never too much. Man, that thing was zing. I said, oh. So I'm doing a monologue now, you know. You know, 67 degrees outside on a beautiful day in Buffalo, New York, where, you know, the breeze is in, I'm in the ear hole with the, I'm trying to get that album back on. I'm like, who did that? And I know it was the dude that before me that did it because he wanted that Wham-O job.
He wanted that Wham-O job. You know, what people don't realize, and we've got about a minute and a half before we go to break, is that back in those days, when you were a DJ, you had to queue up the records, you had to talk, but you had to do two or three things at one time, and you had to be able to compartmentalize everything that you're doing so that you know what the next step is after you do what you do.
It load your tracks, play your tracks, talk to the newsman, the weather person, you know, answering the phone. It was like, it was happening, man, but that was just... I miss it. And I guess if everything falls apart, I could see if somebody will have me again.
Hey, we're going to take a short break. We have Ruben Santiago Hudson. He's a world famous actor. You've seen him on stage, screen, and TV. But we're going to talk with him a little bit more. But I just want to thank those people who are listening to us from Slovenia, Germany, Australia, Israel, Korea, Thailand, and Russia. I want to thank you all for hanging out with us here in Harlem, America. And we'll be right back. This is What's Hot Harlem, America with G. Keith Alexander.
Have you ever thought about hosting your own radio podcast? To establish fame, fortune, and followers for your small business, people listen to them, they subscribe to them, and they love them. As a small Black business owner, doesn't that sound like something you'd like to be a part of? Well, you can when you hire the Radio Podcast Pros at Harlem America Digital Network. Imagine, you'll have a team of creative and technical professionals at your disposal and a one-hour weekly radio podcast to spread the word about your business. Making your business successful with its own media is not for the faint of heart, but it can happen with a Harlem America Radio Podcast talk show. Get a free consultation by emailing gkeithalexander@harlemamerica.com or call D. Daniels at 480-553-5741 today.
Listening to Harlem America.
I love it a lot.
For entertainment.
Check it out. Check it out.
Empowerment.
And health and wellness.
Harlem America. The home of Glasso Smart Water is Harlem America. Harlem America. Where Coca-Cola is helping you enjoy less sugar. You're listening to Harlem America,
talking to the world from the heart and soul of New York.
You're listening to What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander. To reach our show live today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Also, you can send an email to gkeithalexander@harlemamerica.com. Now, back to the show.
Okay, so we're chopping it up with my friend Ruben Santiago Hudson, and we're talking about some of his experiences, and he's had me laughing thus far. So, All right, so let's move from you're being a DJ, and then what was the first major role you got after you left radio?
Well, you know, I was always acting, and radio was like my side hustle. And so I never stopped acting, but running the theater company in Detroit with Vaughn Washington, Dr. Vaughn Washington, was one of the highlights, one of the beginning highlights, because it was the first time that I had to help run a company and be the star of that company. But it was the first time I could do anything I wanted to do and be supported. So from there, I had to come to New York eventually. Woody King saw me perform in Michigan. He was there with his friend and my friend, Ron Milner, great playwright. And Ron told him that Woody had to see, you got to see this guy, man. He's better than anybody you got in New York. And Woody King was like, no. He said, well, come on, let's ride up to wherever I was performing, whether it was Ypsilanti, East Lansing, whatever. So Woody came and he saw me perform. And before I can get to my dressing room, good, he was backstage saying, you want to come to New York? So he had a job for me. And I came to New York looking for the job after I finished my season with my company. And the job wasn't there anymore.
Oh, really?
So I was here stuck with, you know, a couple hundred dollars in my pocket, nowhere to live, more than 2 weeks. You know, my friend said he could put me up for 2 weeks. And I had to try to make my way. And I think the first break that really started solidifying that I was on my way was Soldier's Play. Once the NEC, the Negro Ensemble Company, which was the hottest thing in town, as you well know, when they were doing Soldier's Play with Denzel and Samuel L. Jackson before, and both of them were who they are now,
right,
and James Dickens and Larry Riley and Adolph Caesar. I said, well, I got to find a job. And somebody told me, well, they got 11 black men in this play. I said, well, I'm going to get one of them jobs. Somebody got to move out the way. So when I went down there with all my hubris, no one was there because they were on the road. So and then they also told me, but and what's your name? I said, Ruben Santiago. So tell them I was here and I'm coming back. They said, you're Puerto Rican. I said, yeah, I'm Puerto Rican and black. He said, ain't no Puerto Ricans in Soldier's Play. I said, well, it's going to be one now. And they said, relax. And 6 months later, I couldn't get an audition for Soldier's Play. And it's one of my tales I tell all the time, one of my stories. And then my mother, my godmother actually begged me to put Hudson on my name, my mother's maiden name, Hudson. And I said, I'm not going to put Hudson. My father's Ruben Santiago. I'm Ruben Santiago. My son is Ruben. She said, boy, quit acting stupid. Put the Hudson on. You're Hudson too. So I put Hudson on it. I erased Santiago and just was Ruben S. Hudson. I got an audition for Soldier's Play and got the gig.
Wow.
That was 6 months after I had arrived. And that was the first big break. And then I said, I'm putting Santiago back on my name and erasing Hudson. But every time my agent would send me in for something, they said, where's Ruben Hudson? Bring him in. And they would say, Ruben Santiago Hudson. He said, no, we want Ruben Hudson. We don't want the other guy. So I had to keep both last names. So my real name is Ruben Santiago. And but Ruben Santiago Hudson is also my lineage, and that's my family as well. So that's my stage name.
Fantastic.
But you know, I just got to share this with you. When I was on the road with Soldier's Play, Douglas Turner Ward decided that he was going to do the 25th anniversary. I think it was the 25th anniversary of Ceremonies of Dark Old Men by Lonnie Elder III. And one of us in Soldier's Play was going to get the job of Theo. And we competed and we fought and we argued and we sabotaged each other and we did everything we could to get that job. And one day, Doug told me it was going to be me. So he took me off the road from Soldier's Play and put me in Ceremonies of Dark Old Men. And it was my first big New York off-Broadway production.
Wow.
In a critic, incredible woman named Edith Oliver. Said that whoever this Ruben Santiago Hudson guy is the next hottest thing in New York. And that review got me my first television job.
Really?
And when I met Edith Oliver, I went to my knees. I met her at the O'Neill Playwrights Conference. I dropped to my knees and kissed her hand. She said, get up. You deserved everything I said. it didn't come to fruition yet.
Incredible. Well, you know, Douglas Turner Ward, great playwriter. I was at Fordham University at Lincoln Center, and we did a play called Day of Absence.
Yes, sir.
And And I enjoyed that place so much. Is where it took place in the South, and black people disappeared for a day to show white people how much they really needed us. Even though they didn't treat us well, we were not going to work that day. So they had to run the elevators. They had to mop their own floors. They had to
take care of their own babies.
They had to do all that. So I was so impressed with that play that I went to. I didn't know anything about theater or anything. I called up Douglas Turner Ward one day. And I met him, and I said, "Hey, you know, I'd like to license this play from you, because I'd like to do it." And he says, "Oh, okay, that'll be $25,000." I said, "Well, I'm sorry, sir, but I don't have that." So later on, years later, I met Douglas at B. Smith's one day and got a chance to really find out who he was and everything. But I was really impressed with that play. He was such a great playwriter.
He's a great director, too, and he's one of my mentors. He and Lloyd Richardson, George C. Wolfe, those three have influenced me tremendously.
So you worked with some of the greats, because all the guys that you named who were in Soldier's Story.
Soldier's Play.
I'm sorry, Soldier's Play, because Soldier's Story became the
movie,
the film. Yeah, Soldier's Play. All of you guys have become, you know, big stars and everything. Is there ever a possibility that you guys will work together in a film or another play now that you're stars?
Well, you ever heard that Bernie Mac joke when he talked about when a black folks gonna come together?
No, tell us it.
I ain't gonna tell it, man. I'll let Bernie tell it. But the thing is, we're friends. Don't forget, Denzel produced Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which I wrote the screenplay for.
Right.
So Denzel and I are friends, and Sam Jackson and I are very good friends. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard much of them reaching out, you know, saying, "Rube, let's do something together." People are so, they get into their lives and their careers, and all the rest of the stuff on the periphery gets lost. With me, my mission has been to try to bring us together and fortify the arts community. I failed horribly, but I will keep trying to bring us together in a more supportive way. Mm-hmm. We remain friends and we'll always be friends. And anytime I call Sam or Denzel or any of the brothers, Adolf Caesar was also a very strong influence in my life. They always answer and respond. No one's saying, "Let's get together and do a project together." I've been trying to get everyone to come together to do a Harlem Renaissance miniseries, a four-part miniseries. It's been my life's mission for the last 15 years, and I have not been able to accomplish that. But if I had maybe Sam and Denzel and Halle and, you know, let's name them together, Whoopi. And the only person that really was standing with me on that and was pushing me hard was Louis Gossett Jr. And he made his transition, but he kept saying, "Ruben, we got to do it. I want to play Garvey." I said, "Okay, let's do it." I said, "But I'm not finding the support." So we all end up, you know, people like me, I'm not famous. I'm a working actor. I work all the time. I'm very blessed. I'm a writer, director, actor, and producer. But no one is supporting my work. No one in particular. I have to go shop and pitch, and most times what I'm pitching never gets bought. I don't want this to be a Dear John story, but most of the work I've done is people hire me. So that's why I do theater, because I'm in control. I'm doing the plays I want to do. You can't hire me to do a play if I don't want to do it. Right. You know, usually if you want me to direct a play, you say, "What do you want to do?" And the projects that I'm doing are things that people say, "What do you want to do?" In film and TV, no one says to me, "What do you want to do?" It's never been said to me, "What do you want to do?" They say, "We got something. Do you want to do it?" And then I have to look at it, and literally 80%, 90% of the time, I say no. Because my freedom is most more important to me than anything else. And my freedom is what enables me to be very proud of all the projects that I have and that I do.
Well, that said,
that's deep. That was pretty deep, GK.
That said, two things are on my mind right now. One of which is, What was the recent police show? It was called
East New York. East New York.
East New York. Now, in East New York, you played this great character, loved the character. But you mentioned to me, I guess last week or so, that you got a chance to kind of do your own thing with that character. Explain and clarify that for me.
Well, you know, when that job came up to me, I wasn't really interested because I didn't want to play any more cops. I played so many cops from Shaft, Domestic Disturbance. You just name the cops, soap operas on TV, Billy Cooper on Another World. You just name them. You know, I've been so many Mr. Brooks, cop. So I didn't want to play another cop. And Castle. You know,
Captain in Castle.
So I just said, no, I'm not interested. As I just said earlier, I turned down more work than I take. And and he said, would you talk to the producer? And I said, yes. And we spoke. And he said, well, why, what do you want? And I said, I don't want to play the uniform or the position. I want to play the man inside the uniform, the man inside the mission, the position. Who is the human being? I never get to be a human being. I never have a family. I never have a kid. You know, I'm just attitude. And I said, I'm not playing that. You know, I have to make these roles that are just attitudes into human beings. And I consider myself an expert at doing that. I do it in everything I do. I take something that they thought was nothing and I make them a human being. In American Gangster, you know, Ridley Scott just called me the chauffeur, but I was playing Doc. So everything I did on my own. I walked into scenes that I wasn't even in because Denzel was in. I would be standing in the back. Because I was his bodyguard. So why not call me on the set? You don't have to call me. I'll just show up. Mm-hmm. So I just kept showing up. And if you look at that movie, I'm showing up in everything. When he shot Idris, I showed up. When he walked out of the restaurant, he didn't say, come on, Doc. He just walked out. I walked out behind him. When he goes into where they're cutting the heroin, you know, they told me, stay outside, is what the director said. Chauffeur, stay outside. I walked up the stairs first.
Really?
I had to make him a human being. I had to make him who he was, not the figure. So I said that to the producers of East New York. And he said, that's no problem. That's what we like to see, the human being inside the uniform, not the uniform. And so I take pride in doing whatever is written. I do not ad-lib your stuff. I just have to make it more human and make it more me. And what they allowed me to do sometime is they would say, you know, do your thing. Gregory Hines was the first director that used to always tell me, do that Reuben thing. Just be, you know, so they would say that on East New York, you know, show us something, you know, or I would go to them and suggest something. I said, you do like you want, but it would be interesting if. And they would say, bet, let's do that. And so they allowed the real heart and soul of Reuben to find its way into Officer Sandiford, the character I was playing.
Well, that was a very enjoyable role to see you in, because you really, that humanity really came across in that role, you and your partner.
I tell you this, G. Keith, I was in, I stopped to watch a buddy of mine, he's a former jockey, so sometimes he said, come on and watch the horse races with me. He works at a bar. And I said, but I'm not going to stay long because you try to make me drink, and I don't want to be drinking that much. Mm-hmm. So I walk in and I'm watching this horse race with him on Saturday, I think it was. This guy walks down, this older brother from down at the end of the bar, and he says, you know, I work at the post office. I see you come in every now and then. I said, yes, sir. He said, we know you, and we love your work. And I just want to tell you, man, I watched East New York, and you did a scene where you told the young man about finding the right woman to marry. And he said, it broke. He said, I sat there and next thing you know, I was crying thinking about it, how clear it was and real it was. And I don't want to disturb you, but I just have to say thank you for that. And I was like, thank you, bro. Thank you. When I walk in the post, I was telling him, treat me nicer then.
Yeah. pull you out of the line and let you walk up to the counter, you know, so you don't have to wait so long.
Be friendly. Say good morning, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I got to tell you, there's one character that you did that I didn't like. I did not like, and that was in Shaft. I didn't like that police officer in Shaft.
He was human, though.
He was human, but you were a bad guy. You know what I mean? You were just a bad guy. You know.
Bad guys are bad for a reason, though, G. Keith. And that's what I always try to find out. Why am I a bad guy? What do I need? Why do I need to be this guy? That's, you know, my acting goes deep, 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 deep. I'm never satisfied. Mm-hmm. Contentment is my enemy. So I'm always searching deeper. They wrote this bad guy. And I played that bad guy.
You did.
I knew why I was a bad guy. No one else had to know. Mm-hmm. So, but I knew. And I tried to bring that to that character. And everybody said, well, you shot Vanessa Williams. I said, she had her hand on her gun. People don't realize that she had her hand on her gun. And you know, like Bass Reeves, somebody got to be the fastest crawl.
That's right. That's right. Bass Reeves was a good show, too. I enjoyed Bass Reeves, boy. Okay, so Ruben, we've got maybe about 2.5 minutes before we go to break. And I know you personally as a serious guy, and we've seen you in these serious roles. Would you ever play a comedic role? Would you ever be in a comedy?
I've done a lot of comedies. I've done
really?
Many comedies. Yes. There's a film called The Invention of Lying with Ricky Gervais. Mm-hmm. I came in to do like 2 scenes. They flew me up to Boston to do 2 scenes in it. And I'm his landlord. Look at that movie. Just look at Ruben Sandoval Hudson and the way I play that. I play a lot of comedic roles. And sometimes the best comedy comes from the hardest drama.
Mm.
You know, but yeah, I love comedy. I've done 28, 29 TV pilots.
Really?
I would say a third of them have been comedies. They haven't hit the air because they're pilots, you know, and mm-hmm. you're taking a shot. I mean, out of 29 pilots I've done, maybe 5 shows have came to the network television and been aired, you know, but yeah, I love comedy.
Oh, great.
Coming to America was comedy, wasn't it? Oh, Yo, Man, You Want to Buy Some Toothbrushes?
That's right. That's right.
My first movie. And that's all ad-lib. That's ad-lib.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I got a hell of a head right over here. Check it out.
Oh, wow. That's okay, see, now I got to go back and take a look at that. All right, so we get ready to go to break. I just want to remind people that we are here with Ruben Santiago Hudson, and we're learning about his life and career and what turns him on as far as being an actor. I want to remind you, though, that folks, you can go to HarlemAmerica.com and check out some of our articles and look at some of our prior TV shows. They're all on demand, and some of our audio and radio shows all on demand on HarlemAmerica.com. And I want to thank you so very, very much. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back with more from Ruben. And this is What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander.
Have you ever thought about hosting your own radio podcast to establish fame, fortune, and followers for your small business? People listen to them, they subscribe to them, and they love them. As a small black business owner, doesn't that sound like something that you'd like to be a part of? Well, you can when you hire the radio podcast pros at Harlem America Digital Network. Imagine, you'll have a team of creative and technical professionals at your disposal and a 1-hour weekly radio podcast to spread the word about your business. Making your business successful with its own media is not for the faint at heart, but it can happen with a Harlem America radio podcast talk show. Get a free consultation by emailing gkeithalexander at harlemamerica.com or call D. Daniels at 480-553-5741 today.
Harlem America.
It's about Harlem.
Harlem is my town.
Carver Bank, where 80% of every dollar is reinvested in the community.
Harlem America, the home of Coca-Cola Zero.
You're listening to What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander. To reach our show live today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. Also, you can send an email to gkeithalexander@harlemamerica.com. Now, back to the show.
Okay, so we're back, and we're back with Ruben. But before we continue our conversation with Ruben, I just want to give a shout out to Kevin Bernay, Kever is the voice you just heard. And if you go on whatshotharlemamerica.com, you can see my show that I did, I think, 2 weeks ago with Kever. Very interesting woman. She does voiceovers, and she's incredible. And just wanted to give her a shout out. So, Ruben, you know, you're a very humble guy when it comes to, you know, the accolades that people bestow upon you. And so I know that you're not going to say anything. So I'm going to say this right now to the public, and there's nothing you can do about it. Ruben's got 4 Tony nominations for Lackawanna Blues. He's got a Drama Desk Award, Outer Critics Circle Award. He's got another Tony nomination for Outstanding Lead Actor. Ruben has an Obie. He's got Helen Hayes Award. He's got the Golden Globe, NAACP Image Award, the Christopher Award, and the Humanitas Prize. And I'm sure I'm leaving out several other awards, but I just want to let everybody know that you are a very talented and award-winning man that, you know, in the industry, and you would never say it, but I'm saying it. And so now there, nothing you can do about it. Okay. you know, as parents, we want the best for our kids. And it's wonderful that if our kids choose to follow in our footsteps and so forth and so on. I understand you have 2 wonderful kids following in your footsteps. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my twins, my youngest kids, I have 4 kids. Well, my oldest son is a pastor in Atlanta, Georgia, Mosaic Church. So if you're ever in Mapleton, I had to plug him because it's really, really a wonderful little church. And he's a great pastor. Broderick Santiago. My middle son is electrics. He does electrics at Tyler Perry Studios. He does lights and everything. And my twins are both actors. Lily Santiago was in a show called La Brea on NBC for 3 years. Oh. And then she was most recently on Broadway in a show called Mary Jane. She left Mary Jane, and now she's in on Netflix, a new show coming out called Untamed with Eric Bana and Sam Neill. She's shooting that now. Untamed, Lily Santiago. My son, Trey Santiago Hudson. He wants to keep the Hudson because he figures it might get him in the door. I said, somebody might not like you because you've signed out. Somebody might keep you out. But he's a wonderful actor. He's done film, TV. He just, he'll be on a show called Shrinking this upcoming season. He's in a co-star in a movie called Vineyards. But more recently coming up, he is going to be in John Leguizamo's world premiere of a play called The Other Americans. The world premiere will be at the Arena Theater in Washington, D.C., beginning the end of October. Trey Santiago Hudson. You can also, you've seen him on New Amsterdam, The Walking Dead. He's done a lot of work.
Wow, talking about following in Dad's footsteps. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing. So, when you found out that your twins wanted to get into acting, were you okay with it immediately, or you know?
I only have one requirement. Give it your all. I don't care what you want to do, really. I care, but it doesn't matter to me. I don't push you one way or the other. All I push you for is excellence. So I said, I will not accept mediocrity from either one of my kids, any of them. So whatever you want to do, whether it's a social worker or a teacher or a doctor, or the president of the United States, go for it, you know, and I will support it full. I'll do whatever I have to do to make sure you have the best chance of being that. And that's my promise to them. And their promise to me is we'd give it our all. And they have done that. So we have agreed, my kids and our and myself and my wife. And so it's been good seeing their success. And I'm extremely proud of them. And I'm the biggest fan and supporter.
That's a beautiful thing. So, you've directed some of August Wilson's most iconic plays. If you could have dinner with one of his characters, who could it be and why?
Man, that's a heavy one now because, you know, I love everything about August Wilson's work and everybody in his work. I probably sat with most of them before somewhere in my life. You know? That's why I do the work so well, because I know all these people so well. But I think I would love to sit with Aunt Esther from Gem of the Ocean. I would love to sit there. I don't know if I need my soul washed. I probably do with all the stuff I've done in my life. But I would love to just sit there with that wisdom, because she reminds me so much of Nanny, the woman who raised me. That goodness, that depth of knowledge, you know, and that grace. Yeah, honest.
Okay. So now you did Jelly's Last Jam, right? So,
yes, sir. My first Broadway.
So if you could go back to your Broadway debut in Jelly's Last Jam and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
Oh, man, that was a time, G-Key. That was a time. That piece of advice would probably would be more patient. If I had to give myself at that time, the advice would be more patient.
And why?
Because, you know, when that play started out, I had 3 songs in it. And by the time it got to Broadway, I had 1 song. And I was just so upset. And my role was cut so bad, I just walked out one day. I just walked away from it, walked out. And Gregory Hines had to come get me and tell me, just be patient, man. Your time's coming. You're going to shine in this show and you're going to shine in many shows. Be patient. And I reared up and screamed and hollered and cussed and spoke different languages. And then finally, he picked me up, took me to lunch. And George called me, quit acting that way. And, you know, and I came back and I listened and stayed in the show and I did shine. And it was one of the greatest opportunities I've ever had in my life to work with that cast at that time, that director, and be with my brother Gregory, who was my dearest friend, in a lot of ways, a mentor. And he taught me a lot. So I would have been more patient. You know, I'd have just not walked out. I would have just said, okay, you know, it's your play. Do your thing. I'm going to do my thing and I'll be here. But that's not the way I took it. I was not patient about it.
All right, so you played many roles, but which one would you say is the closest to your own personality and why?
It's on stage. You know, it's Lackawanna Blues. It is me. It's me as an 11-year-old boy dealing with things that I have put away in my mind and in my heart in a little dark place and closed the door. I had to open up that door again. So I had to really just be me and feel all the feelings that I didn't want to feel and embrace all those wonderful feelings that I missed so much that I didn't want to feel. So it's me, you know, and even when I play those 26 characters, I play in that play. And let me just correct something. Lackawanna Blues did not get 4 Tony nominations. Skeleton Crew got 4 Tony nominations. Lackawanna Blues got 1 Tony nomination, and that Tony nomination was for Best Lead Actor in a Play.
I'm glad you corrected that.
It was almost a travesty that what happened in Lackawanna Blues, because I was the second play to open up in the pandemic, not after the pandemic, the pandemic. I opened up the Manhattan Theater Club, opened the doors. I assured everybody that they would be safe. We had to put seats two rows behind each other, 6 people apart. So financially, I lost a lot, because Lackawanna Blues had been a tremendous hit all over the country for 28, 29 months. I toured that play and sold it out all over this country with Bill Simmons Jr. and on guitar. And to come to Broadway and see that I could not sell all the seats because we were in a pandemic, just to look out there and see empty seats was like, oh. But the people who did show, they showed up courageous. They showed up open and willing to accept the love that I wanted to give them from the stage, that Nanny wanted to give them. And it was a tremendous experience for me, a dream come true, to bring Nanny to Broadway, to bring Bill Simmons and his music, even though he had made his transition and had gone, to bring Bill Simmons' music to Broadway. I promised him 15 years earlier, we're going to Broadway one day. And just to make that happen. But that's me, Lackawanna Blues.
Fantastic. Well, you know, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you, looking back over your illustrious career, and the chapter hasn't closed yet because you're still writing chapters. Do you have any regrets about anything?
I'm not a person that really, really puts any. I don't put any respect to regrets. I don't, you know, there are things I wish I could have done different, but I don't regret them because they are part of the fabric of who I am. They were lessons that I learned and things that I should not ever do again. I can't regret them. I have to chalk that up to, for whatever reason, the creator wanted me to be in that position and do those things. I made a lot of mistakes. I don't regret my mistakes because they are part of what built me up, and I had to get torn down to get built up. And so I would have liked to have done things different, but I don't regret it.
What would you like to say to young thespians or people looking to get into acting? What type of advice do you have two or three things you can offer?
Well, I would say, first of all, if it's something, do something that you love and give it your all. Don't ever let anyone else determine who you are. That's very important. And what else is very important is never let anyone teach your grandmother's song out of you. So whatever you do, bring the essence of who you are culturally, innately, spiritually to that, because that's the only way it's going to be real. Bring something to the altar. Make a sacrifice if you're asking the gods to give you greatness and great things. Make the sacrifice. And part of that sacrifice is knowing and honoring your ancestors, bringing them with you. So even when I do Shakespeare, Nanny is on stage. And if you watch my performances, my father, Reuben, is on stage and my mother, Aileen, is on stage. Lackawanna is there. No matter if I'm Henry VIII or Lucio or whoever in Shakespeare, watch the lean. Watch sometimes the look or the way I'll do things. It'll be straight Lackawanna. It is straight culturally specific to who I am. As a Black Boricua, you know, so I'll always bring that with you.
Reuben, this has been wonderful to be able to sit down with you and have this conversation in length. I now know more about you, and I really applaud your career. And you, like Gregory Hines told you, you're going to continue to shine, my brother. We all enjoy your work, and you keep up the great work.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for your patience with me and finally finding making the time to be here with you. And keep doing your work. You know, you've been a spokesman for our community, and you've given a seat and an opportunity to many, many people. And I'm grateful for this opportunity.
The pleasure's been all mine, brother. So I want to remind everyone that the African American Day Parade is coming up September 15th. Here in Harlem, and it's a big event, and we're going to stream it live on harlemamerica.com. And if you miss it, you'll be able to catch the on demand. Want to give a shout out to all the folks that came out to Harlem Week. And in fact, Reuben was part of Harlem Week as well. And we want to thank the Greater Harlem Chamber of Commerce for all the work that they do for our community. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. See you next Friday, right here at 1 p.m. Eastern on Harlem America Digital Network with What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander. Thank you so much. Have a great day and a better one tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to What's Hot Harlem America with G. Keith Alexander. We'll be back next Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, that's 1 p.m. in New York, on the Voice America Variety Channel and the Harlem America Digital Network. Thank you for listening.